Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by Mubi, the online streaming cinema. For your free trial of Mubi, go to mubi.com/filmstage.
Just sit right back and you'll hear a tale of a fateful trip that started from this tropic point aboard this tiny ship. The mate was a mighty sailor man, skipper brave and sure. Five passengers set sail that day for a 3-hour tour, a 3-hour tour.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast to thefilmstage.com. I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me today to talk about the big screen adaptation of Gilligan's Island called Skull Island, we have DJ Mecca.
What's up?
I know that you usually go by Dan, but I do so enjoy calling you DJ Mecca.
You call me DJ as long as you want, Brian.
DJ Mecca, I need an air horn sound, damn it.
Boom, 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 boom.
All right. We also have Bill Graham.
Woo, woo, woo.
And of course, well, not of course, but unfortunately, Michael Snydell cannot be here today to talk with us about this.
Although I think
big
he
budget
basically
cinematic abortion. Let's call.
He reviewed it on Twitter pretty much already.
Yes, his review was meh. So. That's it. That's all we're going to be talking about today. No other smaller things, no nothing. We're just going to be spending all of our time talking about Kong Skull Island because we do not value ourselves as people. So, before we get into that, let me remind everyone that we can be followed on Twitter at Film Stage Show. You can find us on Facebook, search for The Film Stage Show. You can email us, podcast@thefilmstage.com. And of course, go on iTunes and give us a comment and a rating because we love that stuff. We are also brought to you today by Mubi. Mubi is the streaming online cinema where their curators introduce a new film every day that you then have 30 days to watch. That means that you always have a choice of 30 great films from all over the globe that you can enjoy. Mubi also lets you download movies directly to your smartphone or streaming device, so that you can watch on the go with greater ease than if you had to use LTE or Wi-Fi. One of the movies that has come to Mubi, or will be coming very soon, depending on when you hear this, is Silvered Water, Serious Self-Portrait. And this is part of their March Discoveries series, and it focuses on the refugee experience. This is one of two docs that they're going to be showing. And this one comes from Cannes, 2014. It is a harrowing first-hand account of violence in modern-day Syria, filmed by activists in the besieged city of Ordos. I don't know how to pronounce it, but that seems like it might be the way. So check it out on Mubi now. If you would like a free 30-day trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage, and we will give that to you because we love you so much. Gentlemen, any things that either of you would like to say before we waste our time talking about Kong Skull Island?
Oh, that trailer for Atomic Blonde looks awesome.
And that trailer for Baby Driver looks awesome.
And that trailer for, I don't know. I thought I had one. Nope. I guess I didn't see any good trailers this week. That's
wow.
The two that have been mentioned.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I should say that. No. I thought there was a movie that I saw. Except every trailer that was in front of Kong Skull Island looked abysmal.
In front of Kong Skull Island.
For Arthur, King Arthur, Legend of the Sword.
I still haven't seen that on the big screen yet.
It's whatever. Why bother? Let's just get into the movie. So this is Kong Skull Island. It is the newest film directed by Jordan Vogt Roberts. And it has screenplay credits for at least four people, and it stars Tom Hiddleston, Brie Larson, Samuel L. Jackson, John C. Reilly, John Goodman, Corey Hawkins, and John Ortiz, amongst many others, the most of whom, in my heart, is, of course, Film Stage show favorite, Shea Whigham. Here, I am not even joking about that. Here is the trailer.
These are photos of an island in the South Pacific.
The place where myth and science meet.
We use
use explosives to shake the earth, helping us to map the surface of the island.
They're dropping bombs.
Scientific instruments.
Is that a monkey?
So that is the trailer for Kong Skull Island. Out in theaters now, the newest film in the Legendary Monsters universe, I guess is what we're
sure.
going to be calling this. Because it is both by production company Legendary, and it features monsters who at this point in our culture are indeed legendary. So, I'll give a brief rundown of what the plot is, not that it matters. So this movie takes place at the end of the Vietnam War, and it involves a geographical survey of Skull Island, which has just been found in the South Pacific, surrounded by a constant hurricane. And this group goes and decides that the best way to map this island is to drop small bombs, which they will then use to read the seismology of the island. And this angers a very large, much larger than you've seen him before, King Kong, who goes on a rampage and takes down their helicopters. And then it is up to these scientists and their military escort to somehow get from the south side of the island all the way up to the north side, which is where their extraction point is. So, that is the long and short of it. Let's see what we thought. DJ Mecca, what... You wanted to talk about this. You
well, no, I
you
mean,
came
I,
to
I,
us and I'm said, not. "Hey, can I be on the episode?"
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
If that counts as wanting to talk about it, yeah, I mean, that's yeah. I wrote the review and I liked the movie, so I sensed that there would be some sort of, you know, maybe other people wouldn't like it. It sounds, Brian, like
well,
you're
not,
one of those people from
yeah,
your
not, tip my
not so subtle
much,
not so but. Subtle tone. Yeah, I mean, so I wrote the review for the Film Stage. I saw the movie on Tuesday night. Here's the thing. I like this movie. Certainly, it's silly, and there are not, like, you know, like you mentioned, honestly, and this is, you know, a funny thing to say, and I said this in my review, I'm positive on it, but yeah, like, plot and characters are almost kind of secondary to what this movie is, which I think is a creature feature that is fun. And I think one thing that's funny to me these days, where you have so much money going into these multiverses, whatever, where you're taking, you know, like you said, legendary monster characters from whatever, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, you know, you name it. I think there's this lofty ambition that gets put on to these properties a lot of the time that you almost forget that these were and are creature features. Like, just because this movie cost $150 million and $300 million total with the ads and everything doesn't mean that it's not a movie about a big giant monkey running around an island with like dinosaurs and other things. So I guess, you know, I think, and I guess, so I enjoyed this movie. I thought it was fun. I like that we saw Kong from, you know, you see Kong basically from minute one, which is, you know, a stark difference from Gareth Edwards' Godzilla movie. And I enjoyed the scope and the spectacle that's in this movie. And I thought that by and large, it was done well. And the pace was fast enough and fun enough that any kind of cosmetic problems, and there are plenty, are basically rushed through rather quickly. And I think it kind of gets to the heart of what these movies were, which is basically just thrill rides made for way less money 70 years ago. Now, I mean, you know, they shoehorn it into this multiverse thing. So, you know, it's obviously meant to set up a Godzilla versus Kong movie in 4 years, and that whole part of this is hard to swallow on a big level just because of the way that these things are written nowadays. But in the theater watching it, I enjoyed it. I love the Kong design. I love the island. And, you know, Hiddleston and Brie Larson, they're the leads, I guess. I mean, they're not really like,
yeah,
I mean, it's really like John C. Reilly's movie who comes in halfway through and is great. Sam Jackson is literally eating a ham sandwich the whole time. And it's great to watch, even though they like give him these lines that are like self-referential to his pop culture.
Hold on to your butts,
which is so fucking stupid, but whatever. He's fun to watch. And yeah, I mean, I basically walked away from it having a good time. And so, and the other thing, and this might be a point of contention, I didn't really like Gareth Edwards' Godzilla too much because of those lofty ambitions, which I feel like it failed with. So, I mean, for me, in all the ways this was different, I liked. You know what I mean? I kind of like that you have this movie that, you know, in Godzilla, you basically see 15 minutes of the monster, and some people really like the way that that was kind of that netted out, and I understand that. But in this, I like that, like, in literally the second minute of the movie, it's like, this is Kong, and then we're going to basically have him be the guy for the movie. So that's my, you know, that's my feeling on the movie.
All right. Bill Graham, what about yourself? What did you think of Kong Skull Island?
I'm probably in the middle of y'all, of you two. I enjoyed the movie for the most part. It is like Mecca is saying, it is big and dumb and silly, but the action, some of the set pieces, particularly the way that Kong looks, is pretty phenomenal. I really think they nailed kind of the look of Kong. Going in, I wasn't quite sure how that was gonna kind of fold out. His introduction, when he starts swatting helicopters out of the sky, that's some pretty good cinema for my taste. It's everything we kind of want out of the film like this, where we have, you know, these weapons of destruction going up against a giant ape, and it's like, nah, you're not going to get very far with those things. And I love that he just terrorizes the hell out of all of these helicopters. I think I wish there were like five helicopters, though. I didn't quite understand how many people he was going to kill from that onset.
Yeah, somebody, I need somebody to explain to me why 48 people went to that island.
Someone to explain to me. We see overhead shots of the ship that they're using, and there appear to be conservatively four helicopters on it.
Yeah.
And then there is a fucking Apocalypse Now assault on the beachside village level amount of helicopters. There's like 12 helicopters.
There's at least a dozen. At least a dozen. And that's not counting like the Chinook in the middle of them. And you're just like, wait.
Where the fuck did that come from?
How did you get this many fucking things over there? It's like, man, they this was not a cheap military assignment at by any means. My goodness.
It's not like they take like a company with them. It's like, it's not like they just like took a small squad, like two helicopter teams. Nope. They took just everyone that they could. Half of Vietnam comes with them.
Yeah, and it like totally goes against the setup of the movie, because it's the setup is basically like John Goodman being like, can you do me this one favor? Give me a military transport. Like, just, you know, and Richard Jenkins is like, okay, fine. Like, this little thing, and then that's it. And then it's like half of the United States Army is going to this island.
The American taxpayer, like, before the helicopters are destroyed, just like $3 million.
Yeah. If they were trying to make this a journey that could be swept under the rug, not happening. I think there would be a lot of people that would be like, hey, what happened to my son or my helicopter? Like, we just lost the whole transport. Where'd they go? You know? And then there's even more helicopters to pick up. I really enjoyed that kind of opening scene when they start attacking the monkey. There is a sequence when a helicopter is, I guess, smashed to the ground and then picked up, and you're just like, wow, this is really going for it. It's pretty gonzo kind of stuff. It's the stuff that you would want to see out of a big, dumb sci-fi CGI monster creation kind of film. And but there's all of these dumb trappings that I think Mecca was also kind of mentioning. My favorite kind of trope from any of these movies is to have a guy stranded on the island with some kind of indigenous people who has been there for roughly 30 years and still can't speak to them. I'm just like, wait, come on. Like, no effort whatsoever.
I don't want to defend this movie. I hate that you're making me do this, but he does say that they really just don't speak. And so he understands their intention.
Yeah, like he says they're like beyond it. Like they're like a contented people.
Which is really just the movie's way of getting around cries of racism, because the second you give those people a language, it gets dicey. So instead they're monks, and they can just nod at each other, and he's like, okay, great.
I mean, the movie does a good job of not making him like the leader, though. You know, that would be the racist thing. Like
the goofy friend who crashes on their couch.
Brian, just go. Years. Just go with your hate. I want to hear it. Go.
Okay. Well, I was about to say, ahead. I don't think go Bill ahead. Is done
no,
yet,
no,
is he?
No. I mean, look, the CGI looks pretty good. I wish there was more than one like arachnid, and I wish the ants would have showed up. But for the most part, I don't know. My biggest issue with any of these films is I just wish the monster fights had a little bit more weight, because I'm tired of seeing flashbacks of Zack Snyder's Man of Steel with these creatures just pummeling each other over and over and over and never showing any kind of like damage or anything like that. Like I wish it would have been a 5-minute fight sequence and just go for it instead of dragging it out through 15 or 20 minutes. But you know, that's what you get when you get these movies and they cost this much. You gotta let them fight, right? So
Let them fight. Oh boy. All right. Well, I'll just kick off by saying that I loved Gareth Edwards' Godzilla, in terms of like its scope and its scale and its atmosphere and the way that it did parse out the reveals of Godzilla and the Mutos. I was a fan. Someone on Twitter asked me last night, like, what about Ford Brody? And I was like, you know, I could give a damn about Ford Brody. He's like a useful idiot that you just have to like deal with him every now and then, because he's the point of view character for like half of the action scenes. This movie strands you with a bunch of people who make Ford Brody look like Captain Charisma, and you're just stuck with them. You're just trapped in this place with them. The only characters, I guess, who really grow are Shea Whigham and his like pal, who they have like a Laurel and Hardy-esque thing going on. And Shea Whigham plays like this weird, like zonked out Zen, like maniac who is just like glorious. And I wish that the movie had just like screw the mission, just like have him crash, find John C. Reilly's character, and then they both decide now is the time to get out. Like, this whole thing about the mission and like Monarch and all this other stuff is just so friggin' stupid. And it wastes time at the beginning of the movie setting up characters who never become characters. They're just crappy ciphers. Like, Samuel L. Jackson is like, oh, I'm sad I have to leave Vietnam, and I'm like upset that the liberals are making us leave. And then he gets on this place, his men, who he volunteered for this mission when they should have gone home, are butchered by King Kong. And then he becomes like unhinged, and it's just like, I don't care what happens. I don't care if we miss our boat home. I'm going to kill that thing because Vietnam. And it's just, it never makes sense. I don't think the movie even thinks that it makes sense, which is slightly more insulting. And then I don't know, man. It's such a poorly made movie with such poorly sketched characters. And it does so much nonsensical world building, you know, with like, oh, it's 1970s and Monarch, who I guess is our shield in this world, is like, oh, we're low on funding and we've got to go to this place. And there's this guy who's like, well, I support the Hollow Earth theory, which is usually, you know, I love dabbling in conspiracies and like nonsense like that. I once spent like 3 days doing a deep dive into the flat Earth theory, quote unquote theory. And like the Hollow Earth theory is like usually fairly like racially tinged and also like usually involves Nazis.
Can you, and Brian, can you explain the Hollow Earth theory? Because I don't think the movie even really, I mean, just like so everybody knows what you're talking about.
So the Hollow Earth theory is this idea that the Earth is hollow, and basically that, I mean, it can go crazy. The first like level of the Hollow Earth theory is actually that we are in the Hollow Earth and that we are not on the outside of a globe, but rather on the inside of a globe.
What?
And so you could,
oh my God,
conceivably with a telescope powerful enough, look up and see, I guess we would see China or something.
Brian, okay, Brian, when you're done with your joint, when you're done with that joint, can you pass it over to me, man?
Oh yeah, man. And then,
hold on. So this completely disregards that.
Yes, this is not that. This one uses the idea that there's basically a smaller ball within the globe that we know of as the Earth, and so that Earth is another Earth, basically. And this movie says that there are like entry points. So
hold on. How much of this is like, what is that? Land of the Lost and stuff like that. How much of this is kind of based on science fiction that's just run amok?
Yeah, it's a little bit like that. It's more like Journey to the Center of the Earth.
That's what I meant. Yeah.
So like, okay, there's that. And then there's the idea that like the Earth isn't actually hollow, but at the poles there are openings that are actually dimensions that aliens use to visit us. I mean, it's this whole thing. But like, I don't know why it bothered me so much, but it did, that the guy was like, well, the Hollow Earth theory, maybe because it's some people believe it so hard that it would be like if a movie said like, oh, well, the flat Earth theory or like geocentrism. It's such like a retroactive anti-science like device to use, especially given how hard Godzilla strove to make Godzilla like a natural occurrence, to make him like a hurricane or an earthquake. I mean, it's the cartoonification of this, which I really was thinking that it wouldn't happen. So between the shitty characters, the shitty plot devices, the terrible writing, and the pacing is brisk, but somehow finds a way to become boring anyway, especially when we're stranded in this village with these people. Aesthetically, I didn't like this movie. I feel like Jordan Roberts saw one of those things where like someone takes like a trash can and a bicycle and an office desk and arranges them in such a way that if you stand in a specific point, it spells out love. And he was like, what if that, but an island? And so we just constantly get perspective art in like both a temple that the natives use and also Kong's Skull Mountain lair, which he sits in. And I don't know. It's just, it's so. And then the worst part, I think, is that the movie is like thoughtlessly cruel without having earned the weight of that cruelty.
Are you talking about the second in the series of just brutal flying deaths that we've seen kind of in big budget?
I presume so.
Because there was one in
spoilers.
There was one in Jurassic World that was just like needlessly brutal and just overblown. And this one does it again. And you're just like, wait, why is this a trend right now?
Yeah, I don't understand why. And like in Jurassic World, at least when these people die, when that one person died, they did like some really kind of sexist lip service to making her appear to be a bitch. And in this movie, like they don't do that. So to build up these characters that you should presumably have affection for and then dispatch them so cavalierly is really just kind of fucked up. And it's the type of thing that would make more sense in a movie like Godzilla that had a sense of danger and purpose and utter unfeeling, like, disrespect almost for human life. But here, it doesn't make sense because we've got, like, CCR playing and the helicopters are going and there's a Nixon bobblehead and
Brian,
everyone's like...
Brian.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to ask the tough question here. Okay, what did you think about the fights?
I didn't like them. Basically, Bill, for what you said, because, like, they're not interesting. They're just a bunch of pummeling, and then finally one of them dies. Like, the fights here are super uninteresting and uninventive.
Did you think the Kong CGI was pretty good?
It's fine, but it's not, like, groundbreaking. But, I mean, I'm becoming inured to being able to, like, really praise something for its special effects. Because we've reached a level now where unless it's really bad, it's kind of hard to notice. Especially in a movie like this where I have to presume that most of the environments are CGI. And most of what Kong is interacting with is CGI. Mm-hmm. So there's not really any seams to be seen. Now, again, I loved Godzilla. Godzilla, I really, like, lauded the special effects, but primarily because they did a good job of establishing the scale of him. Like, because this is who I am, a couple of weeks ago, I was like, you know, they got all these Kong Skull Island ads. I really want to rewatch Godzilla, 2014 Gareth Edwards Godzilla. And I did. And my wife was like, I feel like I saw this and I didn't like it. It was really slow. And I was like, well, just sit down and watch it with me. And towards the end, when stuff starts happening and you really start seeing the monsters, she was, like, freaking out. She saw Godzilla walking through, I think it was Hawaii or something, and said, no, 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 no. That's too big. And when the Muto is in Las Vegas, she was just, like, on the edge of her seat because... You are granted the time to really focus on what it means for something to be that large. And in this movie, I literally, like, it's hard to get scale for King Kong because he's just standing in the thing, knocks down a bunch of helicopters, and then from that point on, aside from, like, one scene, he's not really interacting with people.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really just like I'm waiting for the CGI monkey to beat up another CGI creature, and it's just boring, and it's and then you got like the two split teams, and I'm like, oh god, these people are gonna have to find each other, and then they're probably gonna get in an argument, and then you have the skull crawlers, which just don't do anything or mean anything, and they're kind of positioned as like a locust that will destroy the world, but like how. Will they get off this island? Like, I don't get it. It doesn't make sense. There are no stakes. There's no story, really. There's barely any scale. It's just a wasteful mess that I don't really understand. So that's me. That's my thoughts.
Well, I'm glad it didn't offend you.
No, of course. I don't know. Mecca, does any of that make sense to you?
No, yeah. I heard you saying, I think, you know, where I come down on it is that, you know, kind of going back to my original point, I think one thing I did not like about Godzilla was, and I think, you know, the podcast has spoken about this to some degree about other movies where, there was this treatment of the Godzilla story in Gareth Edwards' Godzilla with this ambitious, almost literary zest, which I appreciate. I mean, I think as a filmmaker, you want to try and put your own spin on things. And I think Gareth Edwards definitely did that. But I think it bothered me. A movie like Godzilla bothers me because it's trying to have his cake and eat it too, right? Which is to say that it wants to be this thing about loss and grief and about, you know, political, social things in, you know, like that are almost above the pay grade of a lizard, of a nuclear lizard coming out of the water as we know it beforehand. Right. I mean, mm-hmm. to some degree, I mean, you know, criticism as you get farther away from movies like the original Gojira and all that, like you can add that to it. And certainly there is, you know, obviously with World War II in the background, there is that inspiration for those initial Godzilla movies. But putting it in the actual movie is a next step, right? And I understand that step. But I think what aggravates me is you do that, but also, you know, the Aaron Taylor Johnson character, it has to be in every single action scene the convenience of his POV throughout. And they have to like stitch together the plot so that he'll somehow be where Godzilla is every single time. You know what I mean? So you still have that annoying shit, which is in this movie. And then this other thing with Cranston and all these other things. And I just, for me, it doesn't come together in a way that makes me think the payoff is worth it, right? And this movie is obviously there is nothing as lofty as that in this movie.
Yeah, but not even close.
Yeah, but I think what I like about this movie is that it kind of, you know, it embraces what these movies are and were to some degree, which is stupid fucking movies. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and I understand, you know, that that's giving it a pass, right? Because it's like the idea of it not trying as much is obviously, you know, definitely, you know, a criticism. But I think that's where I come down at it. You know, do you know what I mean? Like,
to me, though, because you wanted to give more credit to Batman versus Superman for trying to be more than a stupid fucking movie.
And I give credit to Godzilla. You know what I mean? I'm not giving credit to Godzilla. I understand why people love it. I don't love it, but I get it. And I don't love Batman versus Superman. But I guess it's like, I was entertained by this movie. Yeah, and if we're going to talk about the superhero thing, sure. Like, I understand there's, like, that potential hypocrisy because, like, when I watch a movie like Civil War, right, and we talked about this.
Yeah.
The thing that really pisses me off is the complete lack of stakes. But I do think in this movie, right, the difference is I want John C. Reilly to get home, right? When I'm watching this movie, I want him to get home. Like, I do care about
sure,
that.
Sure, sure.
You know what I mean? And that alone is more than anything Captain America since the first one has done for me, right?
Yeah.
Or any of those characters. So, like, and also Kong, I mean, Kong is a good character. I just like the Kong character.
What is its character, though?
I like the indigenous nature of the character. I mean, I always like the parts of all the movies. You know, like this idea of
I enjoyed this kind of backstory that they give him, that he's the last of his kind I guess we're kind of
delving into a giant monkey Superman.
Well, let's go into. I mean, why don't we just go into spoilers?
Okay, we'll do that. But first, I have to say that I fucking hate what they did to King Kong in this movie. It's worse than what Peter Jackson did to King Kong in his movie. Oh.
But why you don't like his King Kong? Why don't you like Peter Jackson's King Kong?
God, what is there? I mean, first of all, he's too much of a gorilla. That's a really easy one to get out of the way.
What does that even mean?
Like in terms of character design, I feel like they got too far away from the original. I do like this one in terms of his design, because I like that he's standing upright and he's like more man than ape in terms of how he moves, you know.
You know how he can stand upright, right?
Good arch.
He's got to have he's got to have good powerful glutes. That's what it's all about.
Okay, so
this
just derailed my entire conversation. I don't like Jackson's because it sentimentalizes, and really, like, it's more of a Beauty and the Beast, like, capital B story than a Beauty and the Beast story.
Yeah, but the original, that's basically what the original is.
No, you're not hearing me. It's more of a Disney's Beauty and the Beast than a story of Beauty and the Beast.
Okay.
Yeah. It's difficult when that movie literally cribbed the title. No, because in the original, which I just watched last night, he is like dumbstruck by Fay Wray's beauty, as we all should be, and he grows to feel both possessive and protective of her, but in the way that, like, an animal would over something it doesn't understand that is new to it. And in the Peter Jackson one, it's like he's suddenly very human and is, like, deeply in love. And it's disconcerting, really. It's, you anthropomorphized too much. And in this one, he just doesn't have anything. He's sort of an animal, but he's also sort of a protector of these people. When in the original, again, he's just like a creature to be pacified in the way that, like, you would pacify a kept lion, except in this way you are the one who is kept and you're trying not to be destroyed. So,
but to your point about God, I mean, when you're talking about Godzilla, aren't these changes ambitions that should be appreciated though?
Like, I feel like they're changes for the better in the terms of King Kong. Mm. I mean, he's a very boring monster, I guess, is what I have to say. Like,
yeah, it sounds Godzilla, like generally you just don't like the Kong as much as like Godzilla or other monsters. It sounds like.
I mean, no, you don't understand. I love the original King Kong. I love beyond words to speak. I watched that so often as a child. I own the 2-disc special edition, like, tin steel box that they put out. Like, that is a formative movie for me. Like, watching it last night, it really is startling to realize exactly how much of that movie I carry with me every day. Like, if I want to be cool, I act like Jack Driscoll. If I want to pretend I'm being, like, a fucking asshole, I basically act like Carl Denham. And I married a woman with Fay Wray's giant eyes. So, I mean, I guess I just have been living with that movie in my soul for 27 years. And I don't really have any affinity for Godzilla. I don't particularly like the original. I don't like all the Monster Mash ones that they did. And I didn't really like the 98 one.
Oh, Jesus.
Well, yeah, no, that one was terrible. But I really loved the new one because it got that sense of scale. And, like, I loved the fact that, like, the whole movie was humans trying to enact their will and agency upon these giant things that just could not give a shit about them. And at some point, you just have to stand back and say, we can't do anything, we just have to let these two things hammer it out and hope for the best. And this movie is the opposite of that. And there's, like, no complexity to King Kong. They make him like a literal superhero, like I said. And it's just, and it, that would be fine, except for the fact that the movie is so casually and, like, gleefully cruel to its human characters that it's very tonally dissonant. It's hard to get a feel for what this movie wants to be, because there are times when it wants to be a superhero film with King Kong as the superhero, and times when it wants to be Apocalypse Now, especially because this is the island of eternal sunset. Like, there's so many scenes where someone is standing on the ground in what is full noon daylight, and then it cuts to a picture of something larger or higher up in the sky, and it's like, and it's sunset, because we sure do love that orangey glow. Yeah, I don't know. It's just so many things wrong with this film. It's hard to tackle them all, but I think that a lot of it starts with its deep misunderstanding and reappropriation of what Kong is and should be.
That sounds very old man on his front lawn, but telling the kids to, like, not mess around and play. And I understand that you have an affinity for the original, but like Mecca is saying, I think what they're trying to do here is kind of give him a rounded, like they already took away the love triangle or the love angle, right? So that's nice that they got away from that silly shit.
That's like his purpose. Like, the final line of that movie was that Beauty is, killed the beast is his mission statement.
But Brian, this is not that movie.
That's what I'm saying, is it's not that character.
Yeah. So you can't say, well, they didn't do that thing. I'm saying, bravo, they did something different. And you're like, yeah, but that's his whole character. And I'm like, yeah, well, but
I, yeah,
I think the difference is that, you know, it just how you want to think of the Khan character. I mean, I like in this movie that there's more of a focus on, like I was saying before, you know, the indigenous nature, like the whole motivation is literally just Kong being a king of that world. And he's like, hey, like, what the fuck are you guys doing here? Right. They simplify the whole thing. And obviously there are layers of complexity that are not there that I imagine are, can be aggravating if you want those. Right. But I think in what it's trying to do, and for what the movie sets itself up as, it's good that there's not more of a Brie Larson and the Beast thing, you know, because
Brie Larson and the Beast.
that's not what this movie is. And it's like, you know, I don't think, you know, and frankly, you know, and this is maybe more to the negative side, Brie Larson and Tom Hiddleston's characters are not interesting enough in the way that they're entirely presenting. I mean, you know, like, and that's the other thing, spoilers for this movie is almost kind of silly because it's a King Kong movie, but I love the introduction of Tom Hiddleston's character. And this is a thing in movies that is so like, I will always be tired of it, but never not enjoy it in a perverse way, where it's like, let's find this guy to pay him so much money to do this thing that only this guy can do. And of course it's always a man, right? Like, it can't be a woman who has this talent. And he's going to be in this backwater bar where weird shit's happening, but we're never going to really fully see it. It's just going to be an aesthetic thing, and we're going to really play him up, and then he will do nothing for the whole movie.
It's incredible.
It's happened in like myriad films. Like, a lot of films do this. Like, I off the top of my head, I can't really, but like, I feel like it's even a relative new thing where it's like, well, if we introduce him, cool.
It's
fascinating. Yeah. You're just watching the movie. Like, why did they pay him? What is he doing? Like, he's like, go that way. And it's like, bitch, I could have said go that way. Like, what are we, like, why are we so weird?
He gets lost at some point and is like, I have to go to a top of a mountain to track. And he basically just gets to a top of a mountain and looks around until he finds the thing he wants.
You know, and he tells Brie, and like, he makes Brie Larson go up to the top of the mountain for like the most crucial thing, where it's like, you know, finding the boat and everything. It's just so strange. I don't know.
I want to read a brief excerpt from Matt Zoller Seitz's review. Okay. As he encapsulates who these characters are, he says, a tough, quiet British SAS officer, Tom Hiddleston, who has amazing hair.
Oh my god! And then, his hair. I do.
Hold on. We'll get to that. And then Brie Larson's character is described as a war photographer who looks like a Brett girl and has no meaningful plot function. So this is like that. That's what this film does to its characters. And so many of these films do to its characters is give Matt Zoller Seitz and some other writers just an excuse to write up creative like descriptions. Because, yes, his hair is amazing throughout this film.
Like, the most beautiful frosted highlights.
Yeah.
Her hair was surprisingly light and voluminous for a woman who has been through a gooey, disgusting jungle hell.
Can I ask something? I don't know if this is maybe too nerding out. Did photographers back then not have like camera lenses that like – telephoto?
Oh no, she spends this entire movie with like, I guess a 55 millimeter lens on her camera. Also, every picture she takes is just people smiling into the fucking camera. I was furious. I was like, can you
well and it also why is there
one decent picture?
Why is there a photographer on this thing? Like, that was the other thing that was so funny. Like, there's that one scene where she's like, if you get the same quote from three sources, that means something's going on. And it's like,
yeah.
And I guess
what
their quote was
like, who did she talk to? Like, it's such a weird, That was so the parts of this movie, I saw this with Jordan Raup, and the parts of this movie that me and him were both like hitting each other because we were just like, why is this in the movies? Is every Vietnam politicized line, right? Where mm-hmm. she has line, she's like, I've seen enough graveyards to know what one looks like, oh, yeah, right?
I've seen enough
which your response should be like, so one, right? So you've seen one. Because if you've seen one mass grave site, I feel like you have a general idea.
It wasn't until the seventh or eighth mass grave that I really started to understand the nuances of what makes the difference between a mass grave and just a haphazard burial.
And then all of the, I mean, like his name is Conrad, like fuck you. And then the other, and then his name, John C. Reilly's name is Marlo.
Yep.
So it's just like, come on, buddy. Like just like make the names. I don't know. Like when, I think when you do the thing of the homage thing, right? You want to do one layer off, right? Like so if you want to homage Hearts of Darkness and you want to pay homage to Apocalypse Now, whatever, then like name them a tangential character's name, you know what I mean? Like don't, like when you name the guy Conrad, I just feel like it just feels like film school, right? It's like, it's a small criticism, but it's like so silly. You're like, why are you doing this? Like, if you really love the book, like show you love the book and name him like, I don't know, what was the third lieutenant's name? I literally have no idea.
Yeah.
No, but that's my point.
It just aggravates me. You know, and then like, and then there are all those shots. Like, so all of those things, and this is the Jurassic World problem, right? Like, and I enjoyed Jurassic World as a creature feature to a similar degree. I mean, honestly.
I loved Jurassic World. But Jurassic World has the same problems, though.
Like this, the appropriation, like where you make a movie. And me and Jordan were talking about this. You make a movie, right? And there's a world that exists of movies before your movie. And you love those movies. And so in your movie, you make it clear how much you love those movies. Mm-hmm. That whole thing is getting old real fast. Like in Jurassic World, where he's like wearing the shirt. And he's like, that first park was legit. You're just like, shut up. Just make a Jurassic Park movie. Why are you talking about
what's the funny first movie? What you're talking about right now, actually, I went through like the whole gamut with that. I'm like, oh, he's wearing the original shirt. That's interesting. And then he says he got it off eBay, and I'm like, oh, that's fine. But then when he started speechifying about it, I was like,
If he was just wearing the shirt, it would be great. This is my point. It's like, wear the shirt. Why are you then
just like just giving me a soliloquy? When he does the soliloquy, you could even keep in the part where she's like, take it off and never wear it again. We don't want people to remember what happened there. It was terrible.
I don't know. It's interesting. It's just with these movies, like those are the things
you want to.
This is the reality. This is the reality of our time. Is because we are franchising these movies. These directors have grown up fans of these franchises and then get their hands on one. This is exactly J.J. Abrams and Star Wars and a lot of these other things.
Jordan Roberts is a fan of King Kong.
Well, I know what Bill's saying, because it's like the Force Awakens thing. It's all. You're totally right, Bill. It's like fans, and it's the thing of every generation does this. I mean, it's the American Graffiti stuff that Lucas loved those movies from the you know what I mean? Like, They're in there forever, but I feel like the saturation of the art comes through more now than it ever did before, because it's this like Instagram culture and the whole thing where part of it is because there's little nuance to what's happening I guess the big thing,
it's hard for people in this world right now to not have experienced King Kong or Godzilla or Star Wars on some fashion or another. It's not the same 50s culture back then, right? But now it's like, oh yeah, you know, if you hear the Jurassic Park theme song or you see some of the Godzilla imagery, you're like, yeah, I know what that is, mm-hmm. you know? And it's just easier for a lot of other people to kind of experience what they're kind of doing with it. And, you know, and it's not to say that, yeah, I don't think Jordan Vogt Roberts is a fan of King Kong, but I bet you he probably sat down and watched the films at some point or another to just kind of get a feel, you know, like, and
there's a different problem though between what Bill you're talking about, which is like too much reverence, like the Force Awakens problem, the Jurassic World problem, and this, which is I just need a big monkey. And like, if that's all King Kong is to you, then this movie is fine. But like, it's not what he is, and I don't think that people who made this movie care about what he is or stood for in the way that, to their detriment, J.J. Abrams and Colin Trevorrow cared about Star Wars and Jurassic Park, respectively.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, Vogt Roberts' his reverences are clearly, like, not...
Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, it's like, it's more... movies from the 70s and all this. And, but I guess what I'm just saying is, you know, this is not those movies, right? And I think it's a little, it can be disheartening. And once again, I enjoyed this movie, but it can be disheartening on a larger scale when you watch these movies and you're like, you're kind of like, it doesn't, there doesn't feel like there's a voice that isn't informed by a thousand other voices before it.
Yeah, it's all put together.
And Godzilla with Gareth Edwards did not feel that way. It felt obviously it had a few voices informing it, but it felt like its own thing. I will say two things, and then we can briefly go into spoilers because we've spent so much time talking about this. And now I can't remember what most of them were. Okay, here's the first one. This movie takes its let's kill a character like cues from Apocalypse Now, because Apocalypse Now, everyone who dies, it's a deeply, darkly funny, ironic death. I guess spoilers for Apocalypse Now. There's the guy who gets the spear, and he says a spear because he's like shocked that that's how he died in Vietnam. There's the person who's listening to the message from his mother, and he dies, and the message keeps playing. And in this movie, there's a lot of those, but this is not Apocalypse Now. No matter how many like feints you make towards it, no matter how many times you show a helicopter in front of a setting sun, it's not Apocalypse Now. It's like you said, a dumb creature feature that really leans into being a dumb creature feature every now and then. And so those deaths become jarring. And one of them, like, offends me. And then we also have the fact that this movie treats King Kong like talentless hacks treat the Disney princesses in Huffington Post articles. Like, whenever you see one of those things that's like, here's the Disney princesses if they were all in a punk band. Here's Disney princesses if they were losing their health care, which I swear to God is an actual like title of an article I saw. And it's just like you're using the aesthetic, but for no reason that's like locked in with their original purpose or meaning.
Well, I think I know what you're talking about because I've seen some of the Disney princesses with tattoos, like sleeve tattoos. And I'm just like, oh, great. That's not what we need.
it's the weirdest thing. It's like there's a cottage industry of just putting the Disney princesses in like weird, I almost said positions, but that sounds like something that probably also exists, but is not what I'm talking about. But it's like the Disney princesses, if they were all surgeons, it's like, but they're not. Like, that's not what they're there for. You should not do that thing. And this one is like King Kong, if he was a benevolent godlike superhero, and it's like, but that's not who he is. That's not what that character is. And I don't think that anyone who made this movie got that or cared. And that's just the kind of lack of care for a source material that is to the movie's detriment rather than being any kind of revolutionary or interesting or innovative force in my eyes. So
Spoiler time.
Let's talk spoilers, I guess.
Guys, there's an Aurora Borealis? What? Why is
that? We're saving that. Is that like a, was that a big spoiler? Bill's coming in and being like, guys, yeah. Now that we're, thank God we're in spoilers, yeah. we can talk about the Aurora.
I really did want to talk about that, though. Like, I'm just like, what is going on there?
But
why?
You could have talked about that in the non-spoiler section.
I know, but I wanted to leave thing, something. Though.
What is there to, and maybe this is just me being, I mean, it's just, I love when I come on the podcast and I'm positive, and then by the end it sounds like I'm so negative, and I'm really not. I like the movie, but like, it's one of those things, like, what is there to spoil in this way? I don't know. Like, when you go,
I can't even spoil Who Lives because I don't know half of their names.
The only thing really to spoil in this film is kind of the mythology they build around Kong, and I think we already effectively.
Yeah, see, I mean, I guess I wish that spider had come back. That spider was really cool.
Oh, the bamboo spider.
Yeah,
I don't understand why there was only one.
Holocaust, that guy.
Yeah, that was terrifying.
That was fucked up.
That was legitimately terrifying. Like, if I had a kid, you know what I mean? If I, like, you know, took a kid to see that movie, like, you know, my kid, whatever, and it, you know, I, you know, because if you, you know, PG-13 Kong, you're like, oh, maybe I'll go. You know, I can understand a parent being like, oh, my kid's 9. You know what I mean? Like,
well, yeah,
this could be fun, and then you just see someone's like. It's like a horrifying image. Like, if I were 9 and I saw that, I would be like, no, no, nope. Like, it is.
That would shake me to my core.
Any trip that your parent, like, offers up, like, hey, let's go to Hawaii. And you're like, wait, isn't that an island? Nope, 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 nope. Not going there. Not going there.
As long as
we
don't have any bamboo around.
I do like the running joke of what is and isn't an island throughout this entire film.
Oh, that's not a running joke. It's just like
that's a running joke. They literally have it at the end. It is a punchline at the end where they're like, "Let's go to the Keys."
Yeah, but that's not
the key. You mean the key? His team saying Key West and how it's a key and not an island. That whole thing.
I think that's not a running joke. There's literally a scene where him and Shea Whigham are like having a conversation about what is and isn't an island, because he's like, Vietnam's not an island. Also, the Keys aren't an island. They're keys. And then at the end, he just says, does this feel like the way home to the Keys? And everyone's like, yeah.
But there are a lot of motif-y things that, and like, to go against my own positive review once more, with these things, I think what's an easy criticism, and it's a true criticism, is like, you know, in lieu of actual character development, right, you have all of these things that they say, like dear, like they do the Dear Billy thing, the whole movie. And then, like, it's just so interesting. I always want to know, I want to, like, be in the screenwriting room or, like, the development room where, like, Tom Hiddleston has this little monologue about his dad that feels so tacked on. And it's one of those things where when you're watching it, you're just like, why, like, nothing feels more like a studio note than that moment, because
you introduce him
as this mysterious warrior, but he's not. And then somewhere in the middle of the movie, there's like the beginning of a non-romance between Brie Larson and Tom Hiddleston. And then, like, he has a sting about his dad in a lighter, and he was a pilot in World War II. And you're literally like, I was literally in the theater like, why the fuck are you saying anything right now? Like, dude, just like, it just was so interesting to me where, you know, John Goodman had a little moment and Sam Jackson had a little moment and John C. Reilly obviously has a couple, and they all feel way more organic.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then, like, Brie Larson. And then the funniest thing about that is Brie Larson has nothing. And you're just like, well, why? You know, like, if you're going to, I don't know, there's just something so interesting about
it. Yeah, why not the female characters?
It's the classic, how do we make these two characters seem like they're closer than they are? Oh, we'll have one of them tell a story about their dad. Mm-hmm. It's, like, rarely a story about a mom either, because I guess, like, the assumption is that, like, your mom is always around, so of course you're going to have a shit ton of memories about her. But if your dad does something nice, like, then I guess that's really special. And he's like, oh, yeah, my dad, who was an RAF pilot, and blah, blah, blah. And then it's just like, oh, well, we must be in love now. Because you told me a story about your dad, and in Hollywood, that's man shorthand for, I really dig you, and I'm going to tell you a story about my dad.
There's just there's so many things like that in this movie that are just so funny. You know,
that lighter into a volcanic vent. What a bitch.
Well, saves
the day, bro.
I wanted him to say something about that. I wanted him to be like, thanks. Was that my lighter?
Yeah, like he's not ever funny or charming. It's so weird. It's like you have Tom Hiddleston in your movie. Why does that happen? I don't understand. Like, I don't understand
the movie.
With these movies.
He could have been like, you still owe me a lighter. And she could have been like, how about a drink? And then that would have just been like, look at this. You should get me in a room to punch these things up.
Okay. Hold on. So one thing I did enjoy was John Goodman's it does recall the scene from was it the third Jurassic Park film where one of them swallows a phone and so you can track the creature by the phone. And so his John Goodman's automatic camera with a flash.
Yeah, the flash is broken.
Keeps going off. And I really enjoyed that aesthetic, but halfway through that monster interaction, I think they give up on the aesthetic because like they track him, and then he like jumps on the encampment, and from that point on, it never refers back to the fact that he's got this thing going off in his stomach anymore.
Yeah.
And so like there are little moments like that where they set up something fun and something interesting and then they just kind of abandon it halfway through.
Yeah,
like
Jurassic Park 3 had more patience and a longer payoff for their little gimmick of someone getting swallowed than Kong Skull Island. And if that doesn't tell you something about this movie and our slipping standards as a film culture, then it should.
Okay. The other thing I want to mention is my favorite line throughout this entire film.
Dear Billy.
No, it was Mark Evan Jackson, who is in Brooklyn Nine-Nine. He plays a Landsat scientist who's in the room while one of the Vietnam soldiers makes the crack. We're scientists now, boys. And he goes under his breath, you're not scientists.
Yeah.
Like, just deadpan, hilarious. I love that. That is clearly punch up work that someone did. Thank you, whoever wrote that line.
There, anything with Shea
Whigham. That floated me throughout the entire film, pretty much.
Anything with Shea Whigham is great. After the initial encounter with the helicopters, when he's just sitting there eating beans, and his like sidekick is like, you know what? What are you? How can you even eat after that? And he just says that was an unusual encounter or a unique encounter. And he's like, that's the most you can say. And he's like, well, it was. It was tactically unprecedented. We did the best we could in the situation as it was. And I'm like, why is he so cool about it? I thought that there was going to be a thing, but it turns out that that's just who he is as a person, I guess. And he completely misunderstands the story about the lion and the mouse and the thorn. He thinks that the mouse murdered the lion with the thorn. And then this is where the movie, like, again, this is like an illustration of how this movie doesn't understand its own tone, because he and this guy have this like cute friendship, and he has this weird story about his AK-47 that he uses instead of an M16. And then he's going to sacrifice himself to give his friends some time to escape. And instead of like doing anything worthwhile, the creature just like slaps him with his tail and then he explodes.
I love that though, because it's such a send up of the heroic death, and you're like, yeah,
but
he's finally gonna get
this movie,
and then,
is like
I because
it's
this movie is
cruel.
Yes, that's exactly what this movie is, and that's why it is such a mishmash of different tones. And in some ways, that is enjoyable because it is at once unexpected and different.
I think,
but that doesn't necessarily mean it's necessarily good for it. But it is something different, and so you know that's one of the things is like
it's different in a very slapdash way.
this film entirely is predictable and unpredictable all at once. It is such a weird mishmash of just lazy writing that also has that Shea Whignum stuff and all this other weird stuff. Like, the opening sequence in this film, just – I knew I was in for a weird ride when the opening sequence is them shooting at each other, battling it out, and then Kong appears and is just like, wait, so what happens now? Are they now buddies because they see a giant ape? I don't understand what's going on here.
That changes you, man.
I guess so. It's just like, wait, I don't know. The whole idea of stopping a sword with my hands just really freaks me out as well. So,
yeah, I don't know. Just the way that Shea Whignum dies, the way that John Ortiz dies. I mean, they're not, like I said, they're needlessly cruel, and they're not needlessly cruel in a way that makes sense. Like, if this were an Aliens film, it would make sense. But this film does nothing to, like, earn that level of bleakness and openly courts, like, a goofiness at times that would make the viciousness of these deaths nonsensical.
So one of the characters in the film, she is a Asian actress, Chinese actress, Jing Qin. So she was in The Great Wall. She's going to be – or she's in Kong Skull Island, and she's in the upcoming Pacific Rim Uprising. So she is, I guess, the
– Is that still happening?
I guess she's the token Chinese actress in this movie, among others. All three of those films are Legendary Pictures. So I guess she signed like a 3-deal contract or something like that to get in The Great Wall, Kong, and Pacific Rim. Yay.
Yeah, her character as well as Corey Hawkins' characters in this movie are pointless. But then it's funny because for as winnowy and pointless as he is, in the post-credit sequence, he and her are like a power couple team who like stroll in with all the bravado and nonsense that like they never had elsewhere in the movie.
Yeah.
And I'm, again, deeply uncertain of what her point in all this was. I don't know. This movie's all right. This movie's bullshit.
Well, on that note.
I don't know. Here's the other question, and this is something that's genuinely interesting to me. The tone, again, the Shea Whignum death would have made more sense in Godzilla, because that was a movie that was cavalier with human life to a point. The difference in tone between the two of them, and the difference in aesthetic, and the difference in basic atmosphere and thematic weight is so different between them. What do you, like, are you looking forward to more of these? And what do you see them as being?
I have no idea how they're going to tonally match these films, because these are very two different films. And I don't know. I think it's hilarious that they have these flash images of the giant moth. And like, oh, God. Mothra just as a Godzilla creature function just makes me want to laugh. I'm just like, oh, really? And then the Hydra. Oh my goodness. I don't know what they're going to be doing with these things, but I'm definitely curious, and I'm definitely willing to show up and watch, because ultimately these films don't have a very high bar to hurdle for me to be interested in watching them. They just have to be better than the last few Transformers films. The first Transformers film I enjoyed and I would watch again. The last three I would never watch again. And
there's the lowest bar imaginable set by Bill.
You know, That's what I'm looking for.
Do you have any concept of where you think these are going to go or what you hope they look like? I mean,
I don't care about these movies at all. So
okay,
I mean,
so you're
I
not
just,
even going to venture a guess aesthetically.
No, I mean they're going to. Well, I mean, I think they'll fight each other in a couple years, and I think aesthetically it'll be probably pretty bland and uninteresting. You know,
But on a scale of Kong Skull Island to Godzilla. Which do you think it's going to be more like?
I would say it's probably going to be more like Kong because I think Kong's going to do better at the box office.
Yeah, but, that's what I'm afraid of.
But, we'll see.
All right. Well, that's it for our episode on this thing that we had to see. Let's get out of here. What are we talking about next week? Are we talking about T2 or are we talking about Raw?
We're talking about Raw.
Okay, well... I think we should also try to talk about T2 because as a Trainspotting fan, I'm excited that that's happening, even though it's probably going to be terrible. So we're going to be talking about Raw in our main review next week, but hopefully we can get a little time in for T2 Trainspotting, catch up with Renton, Sick Boy, and the gang. Let me remind you all that we are brought to you by Mubi, the streaming online cinema, where every day they introduce a new fantastic film that you have 30 days to watch, so you always have a perfectly proportioned selection of films, and it is always constantly rotating. So you're never going to be overwhelmed by choice, but you're also never going to be stuck staring at the same 30 films. You can get a free 30-day trial of Mubi, so you can get through an entire rotation of films, by going to mubi.com/filmstage. Again, that is mubi.com/filmstage. So, gentlemen, let us tell the fine folks where we can be found between now and the next time that we are in their ears. Dan Mecca.
Twitter, DJ Mecca, and DJ on Mecca. The film stage.
All right.
Why did we not have that queued up?
I don't know. Every once in a while I look for an air horn sound effect, and it's hard to, like, get one that's real good. I don't know what
there's
it is.
There's an app.
I'm too picky about my air horn sound effect. Here, let's try this. I'm not gonna put it up all the way, but is this good?
Yes, perfect.
Okay. Dan, can you say your Twitter handle again?
You can find me on Twitter at DJ Mecca.
DJ Mecca.
Yes.
All right. That's gonna happen every time you come on the podcast from now on.
That reminds me of the little flash thing in the monster. Now, that's how I just see DJ Mecca walking through the world every single time he opens the door. It's like bow, bow, bow.
Right. That and doves.
Okay.
He pushes double doors open, his leather jacket flapping in the wind, his two guns in each hand, a parade of doves, and an air horn. That is how DJ Mecca enters the situation.
That's right.
All right. Bill Graham, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at CableBFG. You can also find me writing on the film stage.
All right, and you can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. You can also find me writing for the film stage. You can find my personal site, dearfilm.net. I feel bad. The last time I was on this, I spoke about how I had an extra episode coming out that I'd guested on someone else's thing. Unfortunately, that guy's hard drive exploded, so you will never be able to hear the episode where me and three Jamaican men talk about... talk about Manchester by the Sea and Jamaican dancehall music, which I know sounds like something I'm making up, but I swear to God it happened. So, sorry about that, but ladies and gentlemen, you can find us here every week. So in that way, join us next week when we talk about Raw and T2.
Someone has to die to make room for you and I. I love girls. Don't care if it happens in Argentina, yeah.